All right, so here we go. So are you covenanted? Part 31. Part 31. For those of you that this is the first time you've ever heard me, don't be intimidated by it being 31 parts. This is actually not the longest series I've ever done. So for those of you that are familiar with The Heart of the Matter, which has 64 parts, but this one may be more than that eventually. Who knows? We're still in Proverbs. We haven't even gotten to the prophets yet and the Brit Hadashah, so we got a ways to go. But we are going to start in Proverbs chapter 5. Now, what we're dealing with, again, in the idea of covenant is we are looking now at covenant through the eyes of understanding the connection between wisdom, knowledge, and understanding in keeping of covenant. Okay, now remember, the covenant was given in Exodus 19. Basically, it was very simplified as Yahweh said, if you will do everything I say, I will take you as my people and take care of everything else. I'm paraphrasing, but I think we can agree that's pretty much it. But in covenanting, we understand that a covenant is an agreement between two or more persons to do or not do specified things. So covenants can be between people. You have something known as a marriage covenant. You can have business covenants. How many of you have owned a house in a subdivision? They have covenants as to what you can and can't do on your property in that neighborhood. Okay? So it's a contract between people to do or not do specified things. You may not be allowed to have your lawn a certain way or put certain signage in your yard. Whatever it is, there's covenants of what you can and can't do. So when we're dealing with Yahweh, so when there's a covenant between Yahweh and mankind, there are conditions attached to the oath on the human side that if the human party involved in a covenant with Yahweh does not keep the covenant's conditions, there are consequences. And we're going to read about some of that today probably as we get not only through Proverbs, I'm going to jump into one of the prophets just for a minute a little early before we finish with Proverbs because it connects up with something from Proverbs, okay? And so we were looking at the concept in Proverbs of understanding as we walk in covenant that he encourages us that we need to walk understanding wisdom, understanding knowledge, and understanding. Because he wants us to dwell with understanding, not just with each other like it talks about a husband and a wife, but with each other and with him, understanding our relationship. The word knowledge, of course, we understand is a relational thing. Knowing somebody is not informational, it's relational. So hopefully we have that. That's another one of those phrases that needs to be, you might want to hang that in your wall just to make sure. Knowledge is not informational, it's relational. A lot of people are busy gathering all that information, but they're not working with it, doing it, interacting, and then they're engaging in a way that has them relate as opposed to just be informed. So it's relational. So then we ended up dealing with this idea of bitterness. And let's go to Proverbs 5 and understand we only got through a couple of verses here. And we'll just start in verse 1 and read through a little bit just to kind of get our context. My son, listen to my wisdom, incline your ear to my understanding so as to watch over discretion and your lips guard knowledge. Wow, it's all there in the first two verses. Okay, he says, listen, wisdom is something we listen to. Listen is active. You hear and do, hear and apply. Listen to my wisdom. And then he says, you have to actively incline your ear, pay attention to the teacher's understanding. He says, to my understanding. He didn't say that you now take this information and apply your own understanding. He says, I want you to listen to my wisdom. And I want you to incline, this is an effort on your part, incline your ear to submit to and understand my understanding. You don't get to interpret. He says, you're going to go with my understanding, and this will lead you to a place where that you have the skills and the information necessary as to watch over discretion. What is discretion? The choices we make and how we apply things. We use discretion. When, how loud, how weak, how strong, how fast, how often. You know what I'm saying? Discretion is how we apply things. He says, you need to watch over, pay attention, having discretion, and your lips guard after knowledge. So your lips are going to have a lot to do with our relationships. I've learned that a lot lately. What comes out of my mouth is messing up my relationships. Anybody have that experience? What comes out of your mouth is messing up your relationships. So you need your lips, you need to guard over the knowledge, the relationships that you have with people and how you're dealing with them, with the information that you have, and then how you're relating it to others, how you're applying it. Now it's going to go into this temptation, this temptress, the other stuff out there, and it's going to be using the idea of a person, a woman. Okay, we're not talking about literally here a woman. It's the idea of something that would tempt you and draw you. That's not the stuff in the first two verses. Okay, you have this first two verses. He's saying, my son, I want you to do these things, but understand there will be other things that'll tempt you out there to go in a different direction than what I'm telling you to do. Don't be naive. Don't be just walking around and shocked. There is going to be this lips of a strange woman that drip honey. It looks sweet. It looks enticing. And her mouth is smoother than oil. By her mouth, it's talking about the words and what there's a temptation. It feels good. It's encouraging. It makes me happy. I feel safe and all. It's going to be all a deception. He says, but in the end, she is bitter as wormwood. And we spent a lot of time talking about wormwood, and now we're talking about bitter. That's why I'm kind of going through this. We left off in part 30 talking about bitter. She's as bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword, and her feet go down to the grave. So we're just going to stop here in verse 4 about the bitter. So that's kind of the setup here. He tells us in two verses, this is the right way to approach things. He says, my wisdom, inclining your ear to my understanding, and guard over and watch over your discretion and how you handle things. In other words, our biggest challenge is going to be, and this is important as we go forward to understand this, our biggest challenge is going to be not the information itself, but having the wisdom of above, the wisdom from above, not our wisdom, but his wisdom on how to apply it. His understanding. Because a lot of times people say, well, I understand that differently. I say, well, it's not about what you understand or how you, it's about how does he understand it? When he said it, what did he intend? What was his understanding of what he was expecting of us? Not what the church has always taught you, not what your parents taught you, not what you came up with on your own. What is his understanding? Because my son is a metaphor for Yahweh speaking to his people. Can we agree on that? Now it's Solomon talking potentially to his children here. And so Yahweh's saying, listen to me, my children, listen to my wisdom, and you need to understand and incline your ear to my understanding, not your understanding. And so this bitterness thing that's going on, so we have this temptress, which is what? It's not a person, it's ideas, it's approaches, thought processes, different ways to do things that will tempt you that do not fit into his wisdom and his knowledge and his understanding. Are we clear? So this bitterness then comes. And so we've talked about that quite a bit. Now let's go to James chapter 4. Okay, in James chapter 4, and we're going to continue where we were from last time. We finished with the end of James chapter 3 in trying to put this bitterness thing together. And I'm going to kind of try to highlight some of what we talked about from James chapter 3. So in chapter 3, we were encouraged that not many should become teachers, knowing that there's a greater judgment. And then we were told a lot about the mouth and the tongue and how that's a problem and it's unbridled and it causes great fires and all kinds of issues among people. And then it led us to the verse 10, which says, out of the same mouth goes blessing and cursing. My brothers, it should not be so. Does the fountain send forth the sweet and the bitter from the same opening? So this bitterness is talked about there, and it's something that we go, oh, that's a problem, isn't it? And so we have to connect those things together as we go forth. And then he goes in verse 14, but if you have a bitter jealousy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast against and lie against the truth. So we know that bitterness has to do with our response or reaction to the result that we got when we went to the honey sweet lips, the tempting other way of doing things, and it didn't work the way we thought it would. But we're still convinced it should have, and now we're bitter and mad because we didn't get it to go the way we wanted. Because after all, the reason we went towards that temptation was because it was going to give us things the way we wanted it. Yahweh really is not concerned about what you want. He wants you to be concerned about what he wants. Okay? And by the way, he knows better that what's right for you than you do. That's a hard one sometimes, especially when we're young and we're coming into our own sovereignty and we realize that we are free to think different than people around us. Maybe we think different than our parents and different than others. And so we have that independence that's going on. And Yahweh's saying, hey, that's all well and good because I want you to have free will to choose the right things. But in the meantime, I also want you to remember and understand that I know more than you do. I am smarter than you. I know the end from the beginning. I created all things. I brought you into this world. You may want to check out what I have in mind for you because I will always be right. That's what Yahweh's saying. That's a hard one for us, though, because a lot of times you go, I know he's right, but I can't see that far in the future. I can't see how that's right. I can't see how this will work out. You have that blind spot. Anybody remember Psalm 119, verse 105? Does anybody know what that is? Psalm 119, verse 105. I'm going to go there to make sure I'm not just spewing and then not saying the right thing. Psalm 119, verse 105. What's it say? It says, your word is a lamp to my feet. Okay? And a light to my path. And we talked about this in the past. You've heard me say this if you've been following for a while. How much light does a lamp cast forward? Not a whole lot. Just enough to see where to put your feet for a little distance. So we walk this walk, trusting him that the path is the right path. Oh, it'd be great if we could see that the path leads right to the kingdom door and we could see the kingdom door and we're just walking along. It'd be great if the light gave him enough light for us to see all the pits that we just avoided, but he wants us to trust us even if we don't see them. And so it's that kind of a lamp. So back in James, he's saying things like, okay, be careful because, you know, you're going to have bitter jealousies. You're going to be bitter that other people are getting away with something. Other people are able to do stuff that you can't do, or they're getting the results doing the wrong things that you're not getting even trying to do the right things. I don't know why, but apparently to get us to train, to transform, to change from what we are into what he is, he needs us to be frustrated. Anybody ever feel frustrated in this walk? All the rest of you are just not putting your hands up. Okay, how many of you do not like to put your hands up? I always catch two or three. One more time. How many of you are frustrated at times in this walk? Okay, so there's a better honest answer. All of us are. We're always getting those moments from time to time where we're frustrated. We're doing what we're supposed to be doing. We don't understand why we're not getting the results that we think we should be getting at that moment. But we're supposed to be treasuring up treasure in heaven, which means you're not going to always see the results right now and here. Is that fair? Okay? So that's what's going on. And so we are bitter because we are not following his way and we want to get a different result. And it's bitterness, it's jealousies, it's frustrations. And then we finally get down to the end of chapter 3 as we enter to chapter 4. And it says here in verse 16, for where jealousy and self-seeking are, there's confusion in every foul deed. So what would tempt you in chapter 5 of Proverbs to go after the honey sweet lips? Well, because I'm self-seeking. In other words, I want what I want. And I don't like what I don't like. And I think something's not fair that's not fair. And everything's filtered through my filter. But he says, if you're going to do that, there's going to be confusion and every foul deed. He says, but the wisdom from above is first clean, then peaceable, gentle, ready to obey, filled with compassion and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. You know what? Maybe you need to take verse 17 and put it up on your wall somewhere and ask the question in the morning and then again in the afternoon or at night before you go to bed. Did I do things that were peaceable, gentle, and I was ready to obey, filled with compassion and good fruits, but also without partiality, and most importantly, as we go into the days of unleavened bread, without hypocrisy? What is the leaven of the Pharisees that Yeshua talked about? Hypocrisy. Okay? And if you don't understand the real definition of leaven spiritually, listen to the teaching called Get Out the Leaven, the newer one that we have. I think it's a part of the CC 101 program. Okay? Go listen to that where we deal with the leaven in our lives. Really important, good teaching to listen to as we approach the days of unleavened bread. Okay, which we have a little less than a month now to get to. So it'd be a good time for you to start listening to those things to get refreshed in those things. But then he says, in the fruit of righteousness, what's righteousness? Doing what's right. It's very complicated, right? If you do what's right, it's called righteousness. But right according to who? Not according to you. Not according to me. Not according to the person who's sitting next to you or your best friend or your parents. But right according to the Creator himself. That's called righteousness. He says, the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. By the way, I want you to understand that it takes two, at least, if there's more people involved, it could take more, to make peace. Okay? If somebody is in your face and they're not acting in a peaceful manner, to make peace takes both working together. Well, if the person would just stop being angry with me, that would make peace. No. If you help them to calm down, or if you recognize that maybe you did something to trigger the anger, there's a combination of things that work together to make peace. All involved have a role. When there's not peace, you must recognize and ask the question, what was my role in this? If there's no peace in the house, if there's no peace in a relationship, some piece of it is your fault. All right? If the shalom, we'll use shalom instead for the word peace. If the shalom is disturbed, there's a piece of what's going on that's yours. Don't just look at the other person. Now, they may be more to blame, but that's not for you to figure out. Just figure out what part is yours. What element of what's going on that disturbed the shalom is yours? Own your stuff and then work on your stuff. But if you do it together, when you go to your brother or your sister and say, there's no peace here right now. I'd like to sit with you and talk about how we can own our own stuff and fix this. Okay, you're always, unfortunately, this is human condition. We only want to look at their stuff. Well, do you know what so-and-so did and what they said to me and what they did? Well, I'm sure that means that they were in the wrong. But what about you? Did you do anything? Now, maybe you did nothing wrong per se. But by not handling it better, you didn't help your brother calm down or your sister calm down or figure out why they misinterpreted and tried to find a solution. Some of us like to clash, and for the video, you can see that, but for those on audio, I'm like pounding my fists together like a clashing, like a fight. Some of us like to go and bang heads with each other. Others of us like to withdraw. Now, if both withdraw, guess what? No good. If one is going aggressively, like wants to go head-to-head, and the other one wants to withdraw, again, no good. If two want to go head-to-head, guess what? Again, no good. We have to be willing to stick to the situation, be there for each other, and try to calm the situation down, own your stuff, and work together. Now, in other words, if you don't feel like you triggered the person, you can say, I'm sorry, because obviously they were triggered. And even if you didn't do it intentionally, it could have been something that they misunderstood and misinterpreted about what you did. And so certainly apologize. I'm not apologizing. I didn't do anything. Well, that's not going to ever fix anything. Okay? If somebody is mad at you, you did something in their opinion. Even if you didn't do it. And so you need to be able to say, I'm sorry that you're responding. Maybe I'm not really sure what I did, but I did not mean to cause this. Okay? Instead of going, well, I don't know what you're all mad about. I didn't do anything. Anybody ever say those things? Okay? But recognize you did do something. That doesn't mean it's your fault. It just means that the other person maybe interpreted it wrong. Maybe you did something and interpreted it right. And you need to own that. Maybe you didn't realize that you did something to step on their feelings or whatever it was that you did. But recognize if there's an issue, if there's a fight, if there's a dispute, both parties had some element in there, okay? Both parties. Even if your element was that you didn't help de-escalate it. Because maybe after you realized and you got offended that somebody would even attack you when you were innocent, well then everything you did after that only escalated it. So even if initially you had nothing in it. Am I making sense? And the reason I'm going all through this is because verse 1 of chapter 4 says, where do fightings and strivings come from among you? So it's not like I'm just asking a random question here. Yaakov, James is asking the same question. Now, by the way, would he ask this question unless it was happening? No. He's not going to say, where do strivings and fightings come from unless they were striving and fighting? So don't feel bad. They were doing it back then. Nothing a whole lot has changed. People are people. And we are not good at this thing called life. All right? Where do fightings and strivings come from? Do they not come from your pleasures that battle in your members? You desire and don't have. You murder and are jealous and are unable to obtain. You strive and fight and you do not possess because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask evilly in order to spend it on your pleasures. Okay, so what is he saying? He says, look, we're filter everything through me. That thing inside of you called the me, the I, the ego, whatever it is. I'm not a psychology person to have the right terms. But you're filtering it through the whatever is that me, I that's in you. And you want and you desire. And by the way, when you desire, you may just desire things to be a certain way. You may desire to be treated a certain way. You may desire other people to behave a certain way. You may desire all kinds of things. So it's not like a desire is like, I'm just being all about me. I want stuff for me. You may have a control problem where it really irritates the you-know-what out of you because other people are doing things that around you that they shouldn't be doing. And it drives you nuts because you can't stop them. Or you're the person on the receiving side of it, and it's driving you nuts because people are trying to make you stop, and it's none of their business. Okay? We have it on both sides. What did I say before? On every situation, both sides have stuff to deal with. Either the dishing it outside or the receiving end of it. Okay? Some of us have a situational lack of shalom amnesia. I just made that up. New phrases coming out of Rabbi's mouth. What does that look like? What it looks like is you're interacting with somebody and things are happening and you do something, they flip out, and from the moment they flipped out, you forgot everything that happened before that. So there's no memory in your head that you did anything to trigger that response. Now you're just mad at them because they flipped out. But everything from that moment previous got wiped out like an eraser just took out your memory. And that person goes, but I didn't just react to nothing. You did this. You're like, what are you talking about? as soon as their shalom gets disturbed, their memory goes blank. Everything before that. Don't do that. Okay? Because if you can't remember it, you can't work towards fixing it and de-escalating the situation and owning your part. See, what's happening is you're just upset because they're getting attacked. And so you're just mad at the attacker for attacking, and you forget, hold on, time out. I need to ask myself a question. Did I do anything that, even if it's, in my opinion, no big deal, that they could have interpreted in the way they're interpreting it? Did I do anything? And that's where you pause and say, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to get you upset. I don't really know what I did. I'm not playing stupid here. And then let them tell you, and then if you say, whoa, that's not what I did, well, that is still valid what they interpreted. To the person who's exploding, when the person said they didn't do it, their feeling that they didn't do it is still valid. They really didn't think they did it. I do this in counseling all the time with everybody. We need to start validating each other. Validating doesn't mean you agree with them. Validating means that you recognize that that is valid for them to feel the way they did if they interpreted the action that way. Because if you had actually done what they thought you did, you couldn't blame them for feeling that way, maybe. Okay? And then when the person responds and says, I didn't think I did any of that stuff, we have to validate that too. They had no thought in their head of malice or to do whatever, and they didn't realize that they had done it, and maybe actually, remember, you ever go to those shows back in the 70s, they had a lot of these shows where the comedy shows would show a scene, an event, an accident, or some bad thing that happened, you know, in a group, and each one shows like their version of it. Remember those shows? And then we see what really happened, and none of them had it right. Because each person is filtering through their own filter. You know, when I counsel people that are in an issue, I make sure I tell both of them at the beginning, I'm going to hear you guys out, but understand that after I hear one speak, I still will have no idea what really happened. After I hear the second one speak, I still will have no idea, except for possibly where they agreed on a few things. Those things probably happened, because they both agree. Two witnesses, okay. But other than that, I want them to know up front that this is not about you convincing me that you were right about what happened. I'm going to only know that's the way you felt about it, and that's how you interpreted it, and that's what your experience was as it filtered through your filters, and the other person the same thing. It's what they experienced and what they filtered. Amen? And then I'm going to get each one to validate the other. I said, you need to understand and validate that that's really the way he felt. Okay, you need to understand that's really the way she felt. Whatever. That really is how they felt. Okay? But I don't understand. They didn't have the reason to. No, you don't get to judge whether or not they had a valid reason to feel that way. You're just validating that they actually felt that way. See, we all filter everything through, well, I don't know why they acted that way. There was no reason to do that. I wouldn't have done that. Well, they're not you. Oh, we need to stop that phrase. Well, I wouldn't have done it, so I don't know why you did it. Well, but then the other person's not you. By the way, parents, your children are not you. Stop expecting them to act like you did. Stop expecting them to think like you do. They're not you. And by the way, when they do act like you do, own that. Because they are imitating you at times. And don't sit there going, well, I don't know why she... Well, listen, okay? I've had to tell some moms and some dads, well, I don't know why she's... Well, because she's you. Well, I don't know why he's... Because he's you. And they look at me like, what? Well, listen, I know both of you. I've seen you. Okay? That's a humbling moment. And the person's like, I'm not like that. Well, I don't know. I live with both of you. Maybe it's a wife with a daughter or a husband with a son. And you look at them and say, well, actually, I live with both of you. And yeah, that, you're both that way. All right? That's hard, though, because you can... How many can agree that we can always see things so much easier in other people than we see in ourselves? Okay? All of us. All right. Well, that being said, let a third party say to you, actually, that thing you're so mad at that person for, the rest of us are frustrated because you do it too. And isn't it interesting that when the other person did it, it bothers you, but it doesn't seem to bother you that you're doing it to the rest of us. All right? But we do this. This is called hypocrisy. We're all walking that hypocrisy because, boy, and by the way, the things generally, I'm not going to say this goes across the board, but the things that generally really bother you the most are probably the things you do. That when other people do it, it bothers you. I don't know why that is, but it's just, I've seen it. Okay, when other people do stuff and it really irritates you, you might want to ask the question, I wonder if I do this too. Because you probably do. Because the people that are doing it probably have watched you do it and learned it from you. Okay? Especially if they're your children. So he says here, where do these fighting and strivings come from? Well, they come from us desiring. So what are we desiring? We desire stuff that we either don't get or can't have, or we desire, you know what? The biggest problem is when we desire the world and people to live and act the way we think they should. Can we own that one a little bit? And when people around, do you understand that you have no control over most of the people in the world? You barely have control over you. Sometimes that's a real struggle. And so why do you think that you should have any control over anybody else? Control only comes, do you know that Yahweh has no control over any of us unless we choose to submit to him? Now, he could decide that he's tired of all that rebellion and just wipe you out. But he doesn't have any control over you. He gave you free will. All relationships of authority come with a voluntary submission. You understand what I'm saying? So if you do not have your children, and they're, you know, if your children are frustrating you and because they're no longer voluntarily submissive. When they were younger, they were imposed submissive. In other words, you force them. You will do this, or I will punish you, or I will smack you, whatever. Then they get to be older and bigger and teenagers, and you need to allow them to think for themselves more, and now they have to do voluntary submission, which is really hard. You have to win them over and say, I need you to have enough of a relationship with me where you can trust me and be willing to put your life in my hands voluntarily. When you were little, you didn't have a choice. Now I want you to choose to let me guide you. By the way, husbands, that's what you're supposed to be doing with your wives. Wives, if your husbands are not leading the way you want them to, well, maybe it's part of it's because you're not going up to them saying, I trust you. And I'm willing to submit to you, but I need you to step up then and do the things that you need to do, knowing that I believe in you. And I also know you're going to screw the whole thing up many times, but I still believe you'll figure it out, fix it, make it work. Because we have to stop being, we do this with our wives, we do this with our children, and the wives do it with the husbands. We have to stop being so afraid something bad's going to happen. Do you all understand that stuff is going to happen? It is. Stuff go. Anybody have at least once a week? We'll be very conservative here. At least once a week, something goes wrong that you couldn't control. At least once a week. Can you accept that reality is like a rule, like it's always going to happen? So stop worrying about things going wrong. They're going to. What you want to do is realize that it's how you handle it and what you do next that's important. Do you blow up, yell, and scream? I own that one. Or do you just go over, calm the situation down, and look for the next solution? Because stuff happens every week. Stuff you don't want to happen. Stuff that either damages a person, like they can get hurt, like Armin broke, got his leg broken, or stuff that happens like something expensive breaks. Or some of you had cars get completely wrecked, destroyed, or break down, or whatever, and now you have all this expense. Things that you really didn't need at that moment. And you're sitting going, oh man, this is the last thing I needed. No, you know what? I think maybe when that phrase pops in your head, you need to change the phrase to, I guess this is what I needed. Okay? I don't think I've ever said that before. Instead of the phrase, oh man, this is the last thing I needed. Oh great, this is awful timing. No, maybe it's exactly what you needed because Abba knew where you were emotionally and he wanted to see whether you would pop or not. Failed that test, I got an F all week, okay? But I appreciate that it got my attention. So if you took a quiz, meaning Abba put you in one of those positions, allowed something to happen, and you fail, take that F with encouragement to say, you know what? This is not like in college where your F gets worked into your grade point average. If you take that F and turn it into an A, the F never existed. Do you understand what I'm saying? Yahweh wanted you to have the F as a wake-up call to say, are you finally recognizing that you're not really doing what you need to do in this area? How about working on that area? Because I'm going to keep allowing this thing to happen until you do. I'm going to ask you a quick question here. How many of you have had an experience where there was an area of your life that you struggled, and finally overcame it, right? Did Abba give you then something new to play with after that? Okay, that's life. If you're tired of playing with whatever struggle you've got, figure it out, overcome it, it'll give you a new game to play. A new piece of you that's messed up that needs to be worked on. Now, praise Yah, he doesn't give us all of them at once. We'd never make it. This is making sense. But recognize that you've got a bunch of things to work on, and he's trying to get your attention on one. Figure that one out, and then you can move on to the next one. And the next one will then get worked on, and you move on to the next one. And by the way, as long as you're breathing, you will have something to work on. You will not cease to have things to work on as long as you're still above the ground in a flesh suit, okay? And so accept that reality. And don't be blaming HaSatan for everything. His job is to expose those things so you can work on them. We've talked about that over and over and over again. I know Rabbi Tom talked about some of these things last week. But understand, his role is to bring them out so they're exposed so that we can deal with them. Of course, that's never fun for the people around us when our stuff comes out because it causes collateral damage. But guess what? If you're getting collateral damage, that may be triggering your stuff. So it was still supposed to happen. That's why you need not to run away from stuff. Because when my stuff spills out there, people tend to run away. Don't do that. Stay there because you're supposed to learn how to deal with it and not run away. Well, it's toxic. Well, maybe it's not toxic. Maybe it's a catalyst to get you to work on something. Maybe you're also there to help clean up the toxicity by encouraging the person who's toxic. See, there's nothing wrong with toxic. What's wrong is when it's it's I can't find the right word for it. When it's toxic in a way where it's never, nobody has any interest in cleaning it up and they're just loving their toxicity. You know, so it's basically chronic. But just because something's toxic until you've made an attempt to work with it, you don't know how chronic it is. So you don't need to be immersed in chronic toxicity. You understand what I'm saying? There's situations where after you've made efforts and made tries and you've done everything you can that you say, this is not healthy for me. And you can get counsel about when to make those decisions. But don't just run away from what it feels like toxicity when maybe you were supposed to be the calm, loving person that helped that toxic person to clean up their stuff so they're not being toxic. Do we all understand that covenant is to be walked out in a community body setting? This is not an individual walk. It's an individual walk in the context of a group. It's not just you by yourself, and no matter what goes on community-wise, you just got to worry about you getting in. No, he's selecting out people, calling them to his truth and to his word so that they can be trained to function in an organized group. We call that the body. We call it the bride. We call it the forever kingdom. Whatever you call it, I don't care, but it's going to be a bunch of people, hopefully, living together forever. That is what we're striving towards. Amen? Okay, so let's learn then how to deal with each other and our stuff. Because guess what? When James wrote this, it's no different today. Can we agree that there's still fighting and strivings that are among us? Do we still get in each other's nerves? Do we still get each other upset? Do we still hurt each other's feelings? Do we still have people step on our little feelings bag stuff that's all out there? We all do. It still happens. Why? Because we desire. Well, I don't like the way they're doing that. I don't like that he's doing that. I don't like that she's doing that. Why is that kid doing that? Why don't those parents watch those kids? Shh, calm it down. Talking to me first. Calm it down. De-escalate. All right? You know, when we did at Passover last year, and then again at Sukkot, but we did really at Passover last year, we did a little personality test. And we did it because I felt like if you could understand yourselves better, you could understand other people better. And I think we focused way too much on all the positives of our personality styles. Well, I'm more fun and I'm more leader, and I'm more this and I'm more that. Okay, great. Well, I think what we're going to do then at this Passover is I'm going to focus on all the negative stuff. All the stuff that you have based on your personality style that is not conducive to this stuff Yahweh's trying to get us to do. The stuff you need to work on, push down, diminish, eliminate, whatever it is in your personalities. Okay? And whatever, that was that list that I was reading off of the pad. Okay? Different personalities have a problem with these different things that I read. This was during the announcement. Some of you on the teaching warning, what is he talking about? But the idea of being prideful, arrogant, intolerant, selfish, unforgiving, unreliable, lazy, cold, cruel, distracted, unfocused. I mean, it depends on what, you know, some of you have a problem because you're too aggressive. Some of you have a problem because you're not aggressive enough. Some of you have a problem because you're motivated. Some of you are not motivated. Whatever it is. Because anything that's out there, if it's done inappropriately, while it could be good in one manner, it could also be bad in another. Okay? Okay, I like chocolate. Okay? But if I eat a whole bunch of it, not so good. Okay? In balance, everything can have a place. But I think the biggest problem is that we're all out of balance. Can we agree? And the centering of our balance is Yeshua. We need to find that anchoring balance point, the Torah. And these inspired apostles' writings, like James's writings, to help us understand, we have a problem because we desire. And it starts off with, that's not fair, I don't like, those are the desire stuffs. That's the stuff right there. And then we end up in trouble. He says, let's see how far I wanted to go with this. All the way to 11, okay. So he says, adulterers and adulteresses, he calls all of you who are doing the stuff in verse 2 and 3, adulterers and adulteresses. That's a really strange term to call somebody who's just desiring a bunch of stuff and is fighting with each other. Why would he call you adulterers and adulteresses? What does an adulterer and adulteress do? they step out of a relationship and enter into another relationship. They don't stay in their place where they belong. Can we see that there as a metaphor? He's saying if you would stay in your lane, some people say if you would stay in your weeds, if you would stay in your stuff and recognize what's your stuff and what's not your stuff, in other words, what's your responsibility and what's not your responsibility, what's your issues and what's not your issues, because we desire in areas that are not appropriate for us to desire, and that frustrates us and gets us in trouble. In adultery, we desire someone, not our spouse, and it gets you in trouble. But in all areas of desiring stuff that you don't, that you should not have or should not want or do not need, this he's calling adulterous or adulterer. I think that's a really important distinction to see. Why is he using that phrase in this place? And now look what he says. Do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with Elohim? Whoever therefore intends to be a friend of the world makes himself the enemy of Elohim. Now, not to say here that you should not be friends with people that are the goyim, the Gentiles, those outside the camp. He's saying is, do not have a friendship with the way the world does things. All of this is about approach, process, the things that we do, the way that we think. He says, do not be friendly with that whole thing because you will be tempted to live and act like they do. Be careful of your relationships outside of covenant. He says, do you think that the scripture speaks to no purpose? Does the Ruach, the spirit which dwells in us, intensely crave into envy? So there's a lot of envying. Well, it's not fair why they have that, or this one has this, or that one has that. How come they get to get away with, oh, I get a lot of that. Well, how come they get that and I don't? Or why do I have to be punished and they don't? Children do this a lot of times. They feel like the parents have favorites. Well, you don't do that to her. Well, you don't do that to him. Or you don't do that to the other one. Oh, if they did that, you wouldn't act the same way. Well, first of all, there's going to be some of that because for you children to understand, they're not you. Of course, they're going to act a little different with you. You're different. You need different things than they do. Now, some parents actually are guilty of favoritism. If you are, knock it off. Your children are your children. Love them all equally. Treat them equally. That doesn't mean you use the exact same method with each of them. Children, you understand that what you need, maybe your brother or your sister doesn't need. Maybe they need something different than you need to get to the same result. Because I know that you and your sister or you and your brother are not the same. You don't think the same. You don't make decisions the same. You don't use the same amount of discretion on what you do in the same way. Abba knows that we are children. And so don't think because Abba is treating one of us different than he's treating you and vice versa. He loves them more. Does this? It's not that way. We are all different. And we have needs to be treated differently to get the result that he's desiring with us. Can we understand that? Don't be envious. Don't be jealous. That's what he's talking about. Oh, well, you know, because we even have prophets that said, why do the wicked seem to prosper? And now he says, why are you even worried about that? The key word there is seem. Why do they seem to prosper? It's an appearance. It's an illusion. Don't focus on that. He says, but the spirit which dwells in us does not intensely crave unto envy. But he who gives greater favor, because of this, he says, Elohim resists the proud, but gives favor to the humble. So then subject yourselves to Elohim and resist the devil, and he shall flee from you. In other words, if you deal with your stuff, there's nothing for the devil to deal with. He says, resist him. So how do you resist him? What is he doing? He's not giving you thoughts. He's giving you encouragement to do what were already your thoughts. If you resist him, you're resisting your thoughts. And he has nothing to work with. He's the one that says, oh, are you going to let them get away with that? So that's the thought that came in your head. Are you going to let them get away with that? Are you just going to stand here and take it? Are you going to walk away or fight? You know, is it fight or flight? What are you going to, the enemy's trying to get you to react. But are you going to choose to react the right way? Resist the promptings of the enemy to do the things that really is what you want to do, but isn't the right thing to do. He says, draw near to Elohim, and he shall draw near to you. That's the process. Excuse me, how do we draw near to Elohim? I think we go back to the incline. He says, my son, listen to my wisdom. Incline your ear to my understanding. That's how we draw near to him. See, because when we're leaning on our own understanding, we get in all kinds of trouble. He says, draw near to Elohim and he shall draw near to you. Notice in that process, who moves first? We do. Stop waiting on him. Draw near to him. He's standing there waiting. Are you going to come to me? I'm right here. Come to me. Now, if you're going to start coming towards me, I will come towards you. That's what he's saying. But show me that you're interested. Show me that that's what you desire. He says, cleanse hands, sinners, and cleanse the hearts, you double-minded. So what's the double-minded thing? Well, you're trying to be Torah observant and submissive to covenant. That's one mind. But then you have the other mind, me, me, me. I. Ay, ay, ay. All right? We have that problem. That's double-mindedness. You're trying to please him and yourself at the same time. You can't do it. You can't please both. If you would please him, you would actually get everything you want. But you still desire, you crave. He says, lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to dejection. I think what he's saying here is, you know what? I know that you really want this thing that I'm not letting you have. Fine. Kick and scream, cry about it, let it out, get it out of your system, and then I can pick you up and lift you up. Because he says, let your joy, not his joy, let your joy, what you thought was so wonderful and great and that you want, let that be turned to mourning and dejection, etc. He says, because if you can do that, in verse 10 he says, and humble yourselves in the sight of the master, then he can lift you up. Then he shall lift you up. But you got to be able to do that. Can you lament and mourn and weep and let your laughter be turned to mourning? In other words, you have to let go that thing that you love that you can't have anymore. And maybe that thing is your own self-sovereignty. Get off that throne and allow Yeshua to sit. Let the king reign in your life. But you know what? He's not going to kick you off the throne. He's not going to. He's just sitting there patiently waiting. He's just sitting there and watching you miserably run your own life. Anybody realize that we're not really good at running our own lives? Why don't you just let him do it? Why don't you get yourself out of the way and submit to him? He says, brothers, do not speak against one another. He that speaks against a brother and judges his brother speaks against Torah and judges Torah. And if you judge Torah, you are not a doer of the Torah, but a judge. Did you see what she posted on Facebook? Did you see what he said over here? Did you see that? Why we talk like that? Why do we do that? Isn't that what he's, is that, does that fit into what he says in verse 11 not to do? He says, do not speak against one another. He that sparks or speaks, excuse me, he that speaks against a brother and judges his brother. Because when you say, did you see? You're already judging it. You already have decided whatever it was embarrassing, inappropriate, or some other thing, and you want others to feel the same way, and you go, can you believe that so-and-so did such and such? Or can you believe they said this? Can you believe I heard that? Oh, we need to stop doing that. And by the way, I don't have this problem, but my other problem is I have like a zero tolerance. If you bring that to me, I have to work on more gently dealing with it. I have no tolerance for that. Okay? If you're bringing it to me as information, because I might need to know that some people are doing certain things, there's a way to bring it saying, look, Rabbi, I don't know if you're aware, but there is something that's going on. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but I think you might need to know about it. That's different than, can you believe? Did you see? Because they see the tone of my voice and the expression of my face, and it's like, well, can you believe? Did you see that? I can't believe they said that or did that and posted this. Now you're judging. Now you're trying to get me to get the same emotional response that you have to the same situation. You want me to respond the same emotion. You want me to be upset by it because it upsets you. Now you're not just doing this to me, you do it to each other. Oh, the word goes like a fire through the body. Unbelievable stuff. Terrible stuff. And he says, look, if you do this, you're speaking against Torah. Starts to fall into a thing called Lashon Hara.
evil speak, the evil tongue, speaking against brothers, causing division. He says, if you're judging, you're not doing. He says, how about doing and not judging? You know, James, I love him. Yaakov does such a good job of saying, you need to do stuff. Stop talking, stop judging, just go and do it. Do what needs to be done. It's amazing to me that the Catholic Church, when they first put this all together, you know, at the council and they made the canon, I know they didn't want James in there. I know it. I've read the books to talk about it. They did not want James in there. What a great book. Because James is the one that, I don't know how they ever read from James. Because it flies in the face of almost everything they teach. Okay? And James is the Nasi. The Nasi is the president, the head. Oh, he's the leader of the leaders. Okay? In the Sanhedrin, the head was called the Nasi. And this is the Nasi in Jerusalem, at the Jerusalem congregation. Who was the head? Yaakov, James. He was the Nasi. That's why when he called, you know, Shaul to come, when he called Paul to come, Paul got up and he went. Okay? Because he knew who was in charge. And he's telling us we need to be doers. We need to be doers. He says, there's one lawgiver and judge who is able to save and to destroy. Who are you to judge? All right, that was him getting right in your face right there. I need to make sure I go to verse 12. I think I wrote 11 in my notes here. All right, who are you to judge? You know what? I've said that to lots of people, and they get mad at me. Well, I'm not judging. Yes, you are. How do I know? Because it's upsetting you. And that's where you're judging, because it's upsetting you. Why are you letting that person do that? Why is it your problem? Well, I don't like it. That makes it my problem. Okay, just because you don't like something, I know this is going to really mess up your whole universe and worldview. Just because you don't like something doesn't make it your problem. Just because something comes into your space, your awareness, doesn't make it now something you're allowed to deal with or have a responsibility for. You can actually just allow it to be. I'll say that again. Just because something comes within your range of experience, your awareness, you now know about something, and you probably actually don't even know about it. You heard something about something that maybe whatever. But just because something came into your awareness does not mean it is now your responsibility. Some things are, but just the fact that it's in your range of experience doesn't make it automatically your responsibility. Do you understand that? Because I know you're not living it. Most of you act like as long as you became aware of it, somehow now you have a responsibility because you've been made aware of it. Now, you may have a responsibility to turn that over to somebody else who has responsibility. I may see your child doing something. I may not know if you're okay with it or not. So I may go over to you and just say something like, you may not be aware of it, but your son or your daughter is doing this. And you may get offended, which you shouldn't. Now, of course, if I came over and said, well, you know, I can't believe you let your kid do that. Well, that I understand that's going to cause a fight. Because you can't help as a parent or a husband over with a spouse or a wife with a husband. If someone's talking, you know, in a negative way, you automatically get defensive. But if you could go up to the person and say, look, as a parent, I would want to know, and I assume maybe you would want to know also, but your child is doing this. It's yours. I pass it over to you. I've now handed it off to the parent, okay? Now, if it's something that's causing a problem inside of the congregation, I may say, and I would like you to do something about it so that it's not going to cause a problem in the congregation. But it's yours. You own it. Go do something about it. But that's my authority. Your authority, though, as a member of the congregation would still be that you can go up. Look, I'm a parent. I would like to know if my kids are doing something that's causing a problem or could potentially cause a problem. Do we all agree that we'd like to know that about our children? Well, we don't like knowing it, but we'd want to know if it's happening because we don't like to know that our children are doing things they shouldn't do. But we should need to know. But can we go to each other and share that information in a way that says, in a respectful way, saying, I'm not blaming you. I'm not saying your kid is a horrible, awful, whatever. I'm just letting you know that there's a situation that I think you should be aware of. It's been brought to my attention. Can we all understand that in authority structures, Once you've informed the person who has that authority, you no longer have responsibility. If I go to the parent and say, your son, your daughter, and I've handed it over, it's theirs. Now, if a part of it has to do with the congregation, I will also expect them now under my authority to do whatever they need to do to make sure it's not causing the problem. Wives, if you give something over to your husband, you make him aware of something, you need to let that go once you gave it to him. But he's not going to do the right thing with it. It's not your problem. But he's going to forget. Not your problem. You could ask him, would you like me to remind you? You can ask him if you know how you can help with it, but it's got to be his now. And men, if they give it to you, you need to take it and own it and do the right thing with it. Don't complain to me about your house being out of order. Don't complain to me about your marriage relationships when both sides are not doing it. Ladies, you're not giving it up, and men, you're not taking it on. I don't know how much more to be strong and clear about that. The reason ladies are not being willing to give it up is because the guys are dropping the ball all over the place. Guys, when they give it to you, say, thank you. It's mine now. I'll take care of it. Say, I appreciate you bringing that to my attention. But ladies, once you bring them that information, your relationship is to them, not to the thing that was the information. It is now theirs. You bring something to me. As a congregation, if you bring it to me, it is now completely in my hands how I handle it, like the husband is to the wife. And your responsibility is no longer there for that thing. When you hand something off to Abba, when you're praying to the Father, you need to release it as being now in his hands. Let him choose how he handles it. Is this making sense? It's not easy, though, because it's scary to give up control. Ladies, I understand that. We got a lot of men who aren't doing their job. But ladies, you're not helping the situation by constantly taking it and usurping it, because then they're never going to get to learn how to do their job. How'd you ever learn to walk? I don't know. You fell down a lot. Okay? How'd you ever get good at anything you ever did? You messed it up a lot. The most successful people on the planet were willing to fail more than you, and that's why they're more successful than you. We're so afraid to fail. Failure has all in it the seeds of success. Let your husband fail and keep telling him you believe in him. Eventually, he's going to feel so awful, he's going to get up off his you-know-what and do something about it. Maybe he needs to get into counsel with a leadership group. Maybe he needs some life coaching. Maybe whatever he needs. But you tell him, you are mine, I selected you, I believe in you. And then let him do it. And you know what? It's going to go wrong sometimes. And you know what? Most of the time, he'll fix it. Okay, what makes good leaders? Leaders are not afraid to mess up. Leaders have full confidence that if I mess up, I'll figure out how to fix it. But if I'm so afraid of messing up, I'll never be able to actually do. I'll be so paralyzed by that fear of messing up that I'll never actually try. Ladies, you got some husbands that are afraid to try because as soon as it looks like it's messing up or they do mess up, boy, you're just kicking them and beating on them and saying, you loser, I knew you were going to mess it up. You got to stop that. Same thing with your congregation leader. I'm going to mess a bunch of stuff up. I'm going to fix it. Just like a husband is to a bride. But you got to allow that space for me to mess things up. Same thing with your children. To get them to adult properly, you have to allow them to mess things up, but then you have to also allow them to fix it. Instead of just beating them up and telling them that they're losers and they're whatever, well, you're just a whatever. Stop labeling them. That's a big thing. Can we stop labeling people? Well, you're just messy. You're just sloppy. Oh, you're just this. You never remember anything. Stop labeling everybody. It stigmatizes. And then they just start owning the label. Stop labeling. Okay? Big things. These are big things that we need to understand. Wow. And I thought I was getting a lot further. Okay, we're not going to get to the prophets today, I don't think. All right, let's go back to Proverbs chapter 5. Okay? So we're going back to Proverbs 5. And so I want us to understand in the context here,
in Proverbs that we're talking about covenanting, but from the point of view of us as people, as individuals, as human beings, walking out covenant. Because some of you are thinking, what does it have to do with covenant? Well, the covenant is of no use if we're just going to be obnoxious jerks, insensitive, whatever, people, or hiding in invisibly against the wall people, or whatever it is. Okay? Covenant is a close-knit, the closest-knit family that can be. Isn't that what we're all hoping for? I know some of us are afraid of it because whenever we've gotten close with people, it's really caused a lot of pain in our lives. But this is what we should be hoping for. And so it's really critical that we understand that in covenant, there's going to be fights, striving, issues. Shouldn't be, but it's going to be. Why? Because we're people. And people do those kind of things. We're not transformed yet. I know somebody out there that wrote a teaching that basically said that when you're saved, of course you already know I have a problem with that phrase, that when you're saved, you can't sin. Now I agree with that from the point of view at the end, when you're transformed into the image of the Son, we will no longer be sinning because we'll have figured it out, qualified, and made the changes. Agreed? But until that moment, we're all subject to the flesh. And in the flesh, we are very much subject to sinning on a regular enough basis. So as human beings, we are going to struggle with this stuff. Why? Because the lips of the strange woman, of the strange idea, the different way to do it, or the way we would rather do it, drip with honey. And it's so smooth, like smoother than oil. The words. And that's why people go online and they fish for teachings and they search for teachings that make them feel good or agree with what they already believed. So say, oh, I like this teaching better because it says what I wanted to hear. We got to be careful with that. And then it says, now this is important, that in the end it leads to bitter and wormwood. We've been talking about that for a couple of weeks now. So the bitterness and the wormwood. And that comes from because I wanted it this way and I didn't want it that way. And I thought if I could do it this way, and I want my, you know what? I want my cake and eat it type of thing. I want to do it my way and I want it to work. Well, no, your way doesn't work. His way works. I know, but I want to do it my way and still have him like it. I want to do it my way and have him bless it. I want to do it my way and have him, you understand? That doesn't work that way. Somehow we have to pop the delusion bubble that keeps surrounding us and live in reality. In reality, his way and your way don't match unless you bring you into congruence with him. You have to make that effort, though. Now, all of us want to do it the other way. We want to find a way to bend and twist him to be congruent with us. And then we're frustrated and we're bitter and we're dealing with the wormwood thing. That's where we run into problem. Now, we're going to end it here. I gave you a little mini sermon during the announcement, so that'll give you that little extra part. Because what I'm going to go into next is I want us to understand, I'm going to give you a little taste here. Next is going to say, her feet go down to death and her steps lay hold of the grave. Okay? So we're going to talk about the feet and we're going to see how that connects to covenant, and we're going to go to Jeremiah, and we're going to deal with that, because one of the things that we're going to really make sure that we understand, and this is in Proverbs 14, 12. Actually, why isn't that on here? Hold on, make sure I got the right one. I'll even read it to you today, just so we know. In Proverbs 14, 12, what do we know in Proverbs 14, 12? There is a way which seems right to man, but its end is the way of death. Okay, I want to make sure that we add that in here. So we're going to talk about that next week. Look at how that plays through in chapter 5 here. Her ways, her feet go down to death. Her feet, what feet? The ideas, the concepts, the way of doing things that seems sweet, like honey just dripping. Those ways of walking, her feet, her paths, her halakha goes to death. The way that she walks, instead of that lamp leading you to the kingdom, that the word from Psalm 119, 105, that word, instead of leading you into the kingdom, her word, your way of interacting with, you know, your preferences or finding other teachers out there that are false, whatever you want to attach yourself to, they lead to the grave. They lay hold of the grave. And we need to understand that. We need to be afraid of that. We need to have that proper concern and fear to not go down that path. And that's what we're going to talk about next week. Let's pray. Father, we come before you and we're just so appreciative of the opportunity to build and develop our character as we transform from what we are into what you are. As we transform into the image of Yeshua, the fullness, the character, the completeness that is our Messiah. As we're told in Ephesians chapter 4, that the fivefold ministry is here to help us to come together and to develop that completeness and fullness that we found in our Messiah. Father, we know that you are a merciful Elohim, and Father, we know that we are really bad at doing this. Not always. I know that you encourage us to say that you're well pleased with our progress, but we really struggle because we still crave and desire, and we're still tempted by the me, I's. And so, Father, we ask that in your mercy and your compassion that you would give us encouragement and strength to heed the still small voice, not the loud ones of self-sovereignty and the loud one of Hasatan, but that small voice telling us to get on the path, stay on it, and not to turn left or right. So, Father, we want to thank you. We want to praise you. We want to give you all glory and all honor as we want to be completely embraced in your covenant, where we fully trust to obey all that comes out of your mouth, and that we fully embrace our submission to you, trusting that your way is always right, and that we would have no fear of the path, but knowing that we're in the best hands, the only hands we should be in, by placing ourselves in your hands, the master potter. So, Father, we want to thank you, praise you, give you all glory and all honor, in the name above all names, Yeshua our Messiah, amen, amen.